When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the mind.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, just want to remind everyone to, if you haven't yet, please like and subscribe to the podcast. Check out our new YouTube channel where we are doing video-only content. This week, we spoke about world government, our utopian horizons, and a bunch of other things related to what are the possibilities available to us right now. And also, check out the Discord, which is where we take our Q&A questions. All right, Derek, let's head into it. And let's start with the PKK, which has announced a general disarmament. What's going on?
This has been in the works for a while. We've talked about it in the past, but there's been anticipation that the leader of the PKK, Abdullah Öcalan, who's been imprisoned by the Turkish state for many years now, would issue sometime in the next few months, would issue a call for the PKK to lay down its arms and begin a peace process with the Turkish state. That happened on Thursday. Leaders of the People's Equality and Democracy Party, or DEM party, which is the successor several parties down the line of Turkey's pro-Kurdish political movement, met with Öcalan in captivity on Thursday morning, and then brought a statement from him to be read. The party gathered, and they issued the statement from Öcalan calling on the PKK to, as I say, lay down its arms. This has been talked about behind the scenes for months now. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been kind of working the back channels to get not just to get Öcalan on board, but to get the support of his coalition partner, the Nationalist Movement Party, MHP, the right-wing, very anti-Kurdish, typically party, which now is apparently fully on board with this idea of finally settling, after over 46 years, the Turkish conflict, the Turkish state's conflict with the Kurdistan Workers Party. The implications here are potentially seismic if it actually comes to pass. I mean, I hesitate to make too much of this because Turkey and the PKK have gone down this road before, only to come up short. But the negotiations have involved discussions on Öcalan's imprisonment. What will likely happen now that he's finally issued this disarmament message is that he will be taken out of solitary confinement, where he's been, as I say, for many years, and will be allowed to interact more regularly with people, specifically, or especially with people in his movement, so that he can sort of shepherd a peace process. Negotiations will begin. There are considerations being made for Kurdish culture, Kurdish language, you know, all sorts of things. Political autonomy probably not on the table, but lifting Turkey's Kurds up somewhat from the fairly oppressed state that they've been under the Turkish state for a long time is the goal here. Erdogan views this as a way to bolster his own political base. His Justice and Development, or AKP party, has been lagging a bit lately. Or they still win elections, they don't necessarily win them by as much. And there's a, you know, been a movement of people toward the Republican People's Party, the CHP, which has the mayorship of Istanbul, which may be arguably the second most prominent political position in the country. So, you know, he's looking to get Kurdish support. There are conservative, especially religious conservative Kurds in Turkey who would otherwise gravitate toward AKP, except for the fact that Erdogan and the The nationalists have been, you know, have taken a very hard line. They've arrested a lot of Kurdish politicians. They've, you know, they've waged war against the PKK very intensely. So, you know, that's been a problem there for him in terms of this particular constituency. Erdogan is looking at the end of his what should be his final legal term as president in 2028. He would like very much to amend the constitution to allow himself to remain in office. But without Kurdish support, it would be very difficult to get the legislative majorities that he would need or of a size that he would need to get that done. So all of these things will be on the table. There are also ramifications here for Syria. Of course, the Syrian Democratic Forces paramilitary group or militant group, militia, whatever you want to call it, that's been allied with the United States and controls much of northeastern Syria.
Defenders of freedom.
Yeah. Has ties to the PKK. The YPG Kurdish militia that is sort of the core of the SDF is considered by Turkey to be nothing more than a rebranding of the PKK. It's fair to say it's more of an offshoot. But the plan, I think, is for these negotiations with Öcalan and the PKK to encompass the Syrian Kurds as well and potentially settle Turkey's grievances with the YPG or the SDF and its concerns about having a Kurdish presence on the Syrian border. We're going to talk about Syria in a minute here, but the SDF is still kind of struggling to get traction in its negotiations with the new Syrian government. So that could maybe ease the way for something like that to happen. So the implications go beyond Turkey. And as I say, this conflict has been going on for 46 years, over 46 years. It's defined a lot of the Kurdish experience in the Middle East. And so, you know, it is a potentially huge development. But obviously, we'll have to see if the talks actually move forward.
So speaking of Syria, let's talk about this national dialogue event.
Syria stands at the edge of transformation or deeper uncertainty. The Syrian National Dialogue Conference marks the most significant political gathering in the country's modern history.
The national dialogue event took place Monday and Tuesday. It's supposed to kick off Syria's transition to something else from the current kind of caretaker government to whatever the government is going to look like. Elections eventually, I guess. We'll have to see what form they take. It's going to be several years before a constitution is written and Syria is ready to engage in elections, I think. But the national dialogue was supposed to bring stakeholders from all over the country, different groups, different communities, constituencies together to sort of talk about to generate some broad principles, I think, for how to move forward. It did not include the SDF, despite the fact that the SDF controls a substantial part of Syrian territory in the northeast and including some of the country's most lucrative oil facilities or oil territory. Because the SDF and the government have stalled, you know, their efforts to talk about what to do with the Syrian militias or with the SDF's fighting force, how to incorporate it into the Syrian security state, have basically stalled out. So there was no invitation given to the SDF, which seems like a glaring oversight. I will say the New York Times wrote a piece about this a couple of days ago that suggested that the whole thing was kind of less than advertised. There was it was hastily organized. A lot of people felt like they were, you know, given invitations at the last minute, weren't really given any time to prepare. A lot of the people who attended, who were supposed to be participating, just felt like it wasn't apparently felt like it wasn't organized very well. And what came out of it was basically a lot of platitudes, you know, things about the state's monopoly on violence, which is a, you know, comment directed primarily at the SDF, you know, transitional justice, anti-discrimination, you know, the rights of women and minorities, all in a very kind of vague style, were all mentioned as principles that the new government wants to follow. The most concrete thing that came out of it was probably a statement. This was included in the final overall statement from the dialogue, in which the Syrian government demanded that the Israeli military end its occupation of southern Syria, which, as people know, when militant groups ousted Bashar al-Assad in December,
the IDF basically moved into another chunk of southern Syria, and they've now issued dictates. Benjamin Netanyahu just a few days ago said basically he will not allow the Syrian army to operate south of Damascus. He wants the whole region to be demilitarized. So they're just dictating to the Syrian government what can and can't happen on Syrian territory, at least ostensibly Syrian territory. So this is becoming an uncomfortable situation. As I say, the attendees at the dialogue issued a statement demanding an Israeli withdrawal. That's obviously not going to happen, but still it was the strongest, I think, most unambiguous statement that the government has made since taking power about this situation.
Speaking of Israel, so miraculously, it does seem like the hostage deal that was negotiated wound up going all the way through, but it's set to end on Saturday. So, Derek, why don't we get like a bit of a précis about how did you view this whole hostage situation and what does this looming end mean?
Well, so, I mean, the agreement that was reached in January created this, you would call it the ceasefire agreement. There's no ceasefire. There hasn't been a ceasefire yet. What there's been is a truce. The truce was in place, supposed to be in place for 6 weeks, and included these weekly exchanges of a number of hostages being held in Gaza for people who've been held mostly in administrative detention with no charges. Effectively, you could probably call them hostages as well by the Israelis. And it's gone off without, you know, with allowing for several points at which it looked like it was going to fall apart. It's gone off relatively smoothly. So even this last one, which took place on Saturday, Hamas released six hostages. Now, the pattern had been three a week, so it released six in sort of grouping the what was supposed to be the final two exchanges into one week to kind of race to the end and give, you know, prevent the Israelis from backing out of the deal at the last minute and refusing to release the last tranche of detainees. So what happened on Saturday is Hamas released the six hostages that it was planning to release, and the Israeli government was supposed to release around 600, a little more than 600 Palestinians from its custody, and just decided to not do that. The justification that the Israelis offered was that Hamas has been making these releases, not just of the living hostages, but there was one handover of dead, you know, the remains of dead hostages who had died since the October 7th attacks. They've all been conducted with these, I will grant you, somewhat tasteless public ceremonies in Gaza. And the Israelis have objected to these. The UN has objected. It's been a number of objections.
Derek, I actually have a question about that.
Yeah.
So what do you think Hamas was doing? Because it doesn't seem like the wisest political move just from 30,000 feet away. Is it for, obviously it's for local reasons. It just seemed like a strange decision.
Yeah. I think it's a rally. I mean, it's a rally for them to say, look, we got this, you know, deal done and, you know, this is what we're capable of, and for the people of Gaza to, I guess celebrate the fact that the deal is surviving for another week, or that the ceasefire is surviving. I mean, you're right. I don't fully understand the logic behind this. I think
seems like a strange move to me.
Politically, bad idea. And I agree with, you know, criticisms of this as being, you know, kind of tasteless, humiliating for the people involved, for the hostages, humiliating for the families of the people who whose remains were handed over, probably humiliating to the point of violating international law about the treatment of prisoners, treatment of remains in wartime. But all of that said, there's nothing in the deal that says Hamas couldn't do this. So they weren't a violation, as far as I know, of the ceasefire.
For sure.
Deal.
I was just talking politically, you know, it's if you want it to
right,
last.
No, but I'm trying to, you know, put this in the context of what the Israelis decided to do on Saturday, which was a violation of the deal, just to not release the people that they agreed to free in this last exchange. So finally, on Wednesday, a deal was worked out where Hamas agreed to release the remains of four more hostages who had been killed or have died since the October 7th attacks, in return for which the Israelis released the people they were supposed to release on Saturday, plus a few more detainees in addition to that. And the handover of those bodies was done privately to the Red Cross with no ceremony, in keeping with these Israeli grievances. So again, kind of, you know, taken to the brink of falling apart. The deal was salvaged, with you know, a side agreement at the last minute. But that said, as you pointed out, Danny, the whole thing ends on Saturday. This truce phase, the 6-week truce phase ends on Saturday, with the idea in the ceasefire agreement was that weeks ago, I mean, you know, in the second week of this thing, that Israel and Hamas would begin negotiations on the second phase of the ceasefire agreement, which would be the actual ceasefire, the handing over of the remaining hostages, and, you know, the release of a number of detainees, eventually Israel withdrawing from Gaza, the Israeli military withdrawing from Gaza. All of these things would come in this second phase that was envisioned as part of the deal, but wasn't negotiated in detail and wasn't agreed to at the time. The idea was that you would start negotiations during the first phase to get to that point. Well, those negotiations, if they've started at all, they've started in the last couple of days, because Israel has just refused to participate in second phase negotiations. The Financial Times reported on Wednesday, and this has been talked about previously, but it was sort of laid out in very stark terms, that the Israelis won't negotiate on a second phase. What they want is what the Financial Times called a first phase plus. And this essentially extends the truce without an Israeli withdrawal, without any other moves or concessions. It just extends the truce that's in place right now, maybe indefinitely. You know, maybe they would put another deadline on it. Maybe it would just be indefinite. But this is what the Israelis want. They want to continue these hostage for detainee exchanges, or these, you know, hostage exchanges, for basically until they get all of the living hostages, I think, out of Gaza, at which point they would feel free, Benjamin Netanyahu and company would feel free to just resume the genocide in earnest. There's some indication that Hamas is going to be open to an extension of the truce for at least some period of time. Ramadan is coming up in a couple of days. It will begin. That's a month during which I think Hamas would prefer to maintain a ceasefire of some type. The Israeli government has a very contentious, or potentially contentious, budget vote coming up in the Knesset at the end of March that Benjamin Netanyahu would rather go through without having to revisit all the tensions within his coalition about, do we get the hostages? Do we stop the war? Do we keep fighting? You know, there's a lot of different opinions about this, and far right parties threatening to sink his government. So he would rather put this on ice as well. So they both have some mutual interest in an extension, but for how long and what form that extension is going to take is unclear. I don't think Hamas is willing to just keep exchanging hostages as they've been doing, because eventually they are going to run out of hostages. And although it's distasteful to say this, that's their leverage for getting a full cessation of hostilities and getting to the, as I said, the second phase of this ceasefire deal. So they would not be willing, I think, to just give all of that up and trust in the, I guess, good faith of the Israeli government to take that into consideration. So it's unlikely that the deal is just going to continue on the terms that we've seen, where you have these weekly hostage exchanges. Hamas is also probably going to demand additional concessions on humanitarian aid, which the Israelis have not fulfilled a number of the obligations that they were supposed to fulfill under the first phase of the ceasefire deal, in terms of letting in mobile homes to for people to shelter in terms of allowing heavy machinery into Gaza to clear rubble, to recover bodies, to just create, you know, to just open up some space for building durable shelters or putting these mobile homes in. They've not been doing that. So this is another demand that Hamas is going to have probably for an extension. I think these are surmountable issues, but they don't get you any closer to a final cessation of what's been going on in Gaza. They only buy you a little bit more time. What Netanyahu is continuing to demand is that Hamas have no role in Gaza in the day after scenario, which Hamas has said it's willing to turn over governance of Gaza to something else, a technocratic council or something that's formed by Arab states, whatever. They're not trying to hold on to government, but they're also refusing to disarm, which is, you know, the other piece of this. It's not just political control. It's military control. It's policing. It's, you know, all the things that you have to do with guns and, you know, other weapons. They're not willing to give that up. They're not willing to go into exile. The leaders of Hamas has been discussed. So that seems to be the hurdle that Netanyahu, you know, if Hamas were to agree to that, Netanyahu might be able to sell a second phase to his coalition and might be willing to accept it himself. But there's no indication that that's really realistically on the table at this point.
Angel Reese y McDonald's tienen la clave para un post-game meal de campeones. Una QPC con salsa barbecue y tocino, papitas y un refresco. Los pros le llaman el Angel Reese Special. Llévate el Angel Reese Special solo en McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
En McDonald's participantes por tiempo limitado.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Derek, I'm going to call a slight audible. I know it's not on our schedule, but what did you think of that Trump Gaza video?
I didn't see it. Is it awful?
Okay. No, it's just awful. It just seems like such a strange thing to release, particularly this week, given that this
was
first
about
phase,
like, you know, how what a glorious paradise.
It's like
it's
Elon Musk eating hummus and like Trump dancing and belly dancers who's obviously AI, the belly dancers had beers. But it just seemed like such a strange thing to release this week. It's just very hyper normalization feel to that video.
If anyone hasn't,
I guess check it out, quote unquote. It's pretty atrocious. All right, let's move on to Derek, a friend of the pod over in South Korea isn't doing that well. Let's talk about Yoon's impeachment trial, which has ended.
Yoon Suk-yeol, we've been covering his impeachment. The final hearing took place on Tuesday. Prosecutors restated their case that when he declared martial law in December, it was an act of dictatorship. He was attempting to make himself a dictator. Yoon continued his Yoon offered his own closing statement, in which he articulated again some of his very unconvincing defenses, I have to say, of his own actions.
Just a bunch of fake friends, Derek. Fake friends all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, you know, where he's saying that he declared martial law to, like, raise awareness of the national crisis that he says South Korea is in. The national crisis seems to be that the parliament was opposition-controlled, wouldn't do what he wanted it to do. You know, I feel like if you're just trying to inform the public that you've got a problem with parliament, there's probably a better way to do it than trying to self-coup your government. But, you know, what do I know? He also argued, and a lot of this case may hinge on what kind of orders Yoon gave to the South Korean military in terms of enforcing his martial law decree. The prosecution has alleged that he, and they've had witnesses who have testified, that he ordered the military to basically go into parliament and arrest any legislators they found who were trying to vote to end the martial law, which they ultimately did a few hours after he declared it. But that act itself would smack of an attempt to overthrow the government and basically, you know, prove the prosecution's case. Yoon's argument, apparently, from what I've read on that front, was that the constitutional court, which is considering his impeachment, whether to approve it or reject it, shouldn't trouble its beautiful minds. The judges should just let this go, because the martial law was only in place for a few hours anyway, so he wasn't able to do anything. So what difference does it make what he might have said or not said to anybody? Why concern yourselves with these trivial details? Which, again, doesn't seem like a terribly effective strategy, but I guess we'll see.
It was so good, man.
The court has until June 14th to decide whether or not to give final approval to his impeachment. Precedent suggests that we'll have a ruling, you know, Tuesday's the final set. Tuesday was the final session. Precedent suggests that we'll have a ruling in a couple of weeks, but we'll have to wait and see.
Let's move on to Sudan, and let's start with the increased fighting around Al-Fashir.
The RSF, the Rapid Support Forces militant group, made another major push to end its siege of Al-Fashir, which is the capital of North Darfur State, the last city in Darfur that's outside of RSF control, made another big push to end the siege by taking the city earlier this week. That has led to heavy fighting, not just around the city, but in the displaced persons camps that have cropped up around Al-Fashir, of people, hundreds of thousands of people displaced from other parts of Darfur by RSF violence. That in turn has led a couple of major aid organizations. Doctors Without Borders announced this on Monday. The UN World Food Program announced on Wednesday that they've had to quit. They had to suspend their work in the camp, or in the camps, and particularly the Zamzam camp, which is the largest of these facilities. It holds, I think, around 500,000 people, again, displaced from other parts of Darfur. Zamzam has been declared to be in a state of famine. The need for medical and food aid is profound in this camp. So these suspensions are devastating to the people who are living there. It continues to be the most, like, the grimmest part of a very grim situation is what's happening in these camps and around Al-Fashir. I don't think that the RSF has made much headway in terms of actually taking the city. To my knowledge, at least, I haven't seen any reporting of major progress, just the effect that this is having on the camps.
Let's stay in Sudan and let's talk about these military gains that have been made in the south of Sudan.
Continuing the gains that the military has been making for weeks now, on Sunday, it secured control over most of southern Sudan's White Nile state. There was a town, Al-Qataina, that was still in Rapid Support Forces control. The military took that on Sunday, or at least claimed its capture, which leaves most of White Nile State now in military hands. The military has, of course, also made gains in Jazeera State in recent weeks, which we've talked about. And also on Sunday, it announced that it had broken the RSF siege of the city of El Ubeid, which is the capital of North Kordofan State. It's home to an entire Sudanese army division, plus a strategically or tactically important air base. So breaking that siege, which has been going on for months, is a significant development in the south. And I think, the momentum that the military has had in the central part of the country and still in Khartoum, where it's pressing to drive the RSF out entirely, it now seems to be translating to southern Sudan as well. So there definitely is some military developments there. Darfur, of course, still remains, as I said, mostly in RSF control, and that doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon.
Well, Derek, much like the great Western schism of the 14th and 15th centuries led there to be two popes, in Sudan, the RSF and the military have set up dueling governments. What's going on there?
So the bigger of these stories is the RSF, which finally on, I think over the weekend, signed a political charter along with some groups that are affiliated with it, most prominently the Sudan People's Liberation Front North, or a faction of that group, finally signed a political charter to create its own government in the territories that are under their control. They haven't rolled out the government yet. That's probably going to happen, in fairly short order, but the RSF is trying to stake a claim to controlling these regions. Obviously the implication of this is it could lead to a partition, although the charter recognizes Sudanese unity and territorial integrity, so it's not overtly calling for a partition. I think what they would like is a seat at the table if there's going to be a negotiated settlement to this. The RSF is very much on its back foot militarily, but it still is pretty well entrenched, at least in Darfur, if not in, Darfur and a few other places. So, they're trying to stake out a position ahead of a potential political process to try and end this conflict. The Sudanese military made its own moves in this regard. It has changed the country's transitional constitution, basically to leave the military unquestionably in control. That means removing any references to the RSF that were in that charter. It means removing mention of civilian coalitions. There was a group called the Forces of Freedom and Change, which was sort of the civilian component to the transitional government that was in place, a few years ago before this conflict started. Removing basically any reference to those actors and leaving the military in sole charge. It also means excising seats on Sudan's sovereign council, which exercises kind of ultimate executive authority over what is still theoretically a transitional government. Removing any civilian seats from that body. So now it's comprised of all military appointees with a couple of seats for former rebel factions that are fighting on the military side. But essentially, kind of consolidating its own political situation to counter, I guess, the moves that the RSF has made. And everybody's in their respective corners now. If there's going to be any talks, this will be the basis on which they're held.
We all know Trump is the greatest deal maker in history. So let's talk about this potential deal that the Ukraine and United States have made on minerals. And apologies, I didn't mean to put the article in front of the Ukraine. I was going to say the U.S. and I switched to Ukraine. So the deal that Ukraine and the U.S. have agreed on a minerals deal.
I mean, you're trying to get back into Vladimir Putin's good graces. I understand. Diminishing Ukraine as the Ukraine.
Oh, God.
Well, that's understandable.
It'll never happen. He answers none of my letters.
So this has been in the works, as people know, for a few weeks now. Now, Donald Trump wants control of really the Ukrainian economy. I mean, it's been talked about as a minerals deal to get access to Ukrainian supposed Ukrainian rare earth deposits. But it includes oil and gas. It includes at least earlier drafts. I'm not sure if the one that has now apparently been agreed to includes this, but it included, you know, other things like access to Ukrainian ports and, other kinds of economic pieces for what Trump regards as basically payment for the aid that the U.S. has rendered to Ukraine, military and financial, which he values at $350 billion, which is quite a markup, actually, because as far as anybody can tell, it's been around $120 billion. But Trump sticks with this $350 billion figure and has been demanding, some sort of extraction from Ukraine in return. Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, has viewed this deal as a way to get Trump guarantee Ukraine security, basically to guarantee U.S. support as the war with Russia continues, to maintain Trump's support through any sort of peace talks. But Trump doesn't see it that way. And this has been a source of some dispute. And Trump has been, insulting Zelensky pretty much on the regular publicly for the last couple of weeks. Zelensky has fired back a much more subdued in return, but they have continued to kind of bat this back and forth. Finally, on Tuesday, there were reports that the U.S. and Ukraine had reached agreement on something. I'm still not sure what this is. It's either the minerals deal as it exists and as it's going to exist, or it's some sort of preliminary framework arrangement, the details of which still have to be hammered out. Unsurprisingly, Trump views it one way. Zelensky views it another way. Trump views it as a done deal, and this is it. We're getting the minerals, we're getting the rare earths, we're getting all the beautiful things, and we're getting billions and billions of dollars.
Love a good rare earth.
to pay us back. Zelensky is supposed to come to the U.S. on Friday to sign this thing, but he's still talking about it in terms of this is just a preliminary thing and I'm going to talk to Trump and we're going to work things out, particularly when it comes to the idea of security guarantees, because there apparently is not one in this document that has been agreed to. And Zelensky has couched, again, his agreement in terms of, like, this is just an outline, and we're going to talk about security guarantees, and Trump's going to give us something. Trump has refused over and over again and keeps telling people he will not give Ukraine any security guarantees. He has suggested that the mere presence of U.S. personnel and companies as they go over to exploit this new mercantile colony that the U.S. is creating in Ukraine, and I don't mean to laugh, but it is absurd how this is working out, that basically the presence of the United States and, you know, it kind of exploiting these resources and developing them is in itself a security guarantee, because nobody would dare attack Ukraine with Americans there, or lest they, you know, incur Donald Trump's wrath, I guess. I don't find that terribly convincing, but that seems to be his position on the issue of security guarantees. So I think this is still very much up in the air. I'm not even sure Zelensky's actually going to make the trip on Friday to do this. I mean, at this point, it's Thursday. It may be a done deal. His plane may be booked or whatever. But I'm still not sure this is going to lead to anything productive or anything more productive than just more kind of carping in public from Trump. But at this point, the sense seems to be that they are on the same page to some degree, but they still need to work out some details behind this.
Let's talk about the big news of the week when it comes to European politics, and that was the German election results.
Centrist Democrats will run Germany's government as opposed to centrist leftists, this after winning yesterday's highly anticipated elections. President Trump celebrated that victory at a post online, writing in part, "This is a great day for Germany and for the United States," although he may not be talking necessarily about the governing coalition coming to be. We'll talk about that more in a minute. Frederick Merz is the man poised to be Germany's next chancellor, and he has said upon the selection result that he wants Germany to act and think more independently from the United States, asserting that the Trump administration is, quote, largely indifferent to the fate of Europe.
German voters headed to the polls on Sunday to elect a parliament. The result was broadly as had been predicted in pre-election polling. The conservative Christian Democratic Union, or rather its alliance with the Christian Social Union, which is the CDU's sister party in
CDU
Bavaria.
CDU/CSU, yeah, the classic coalition.
Emerged victorious with a relatively poor result, historically speaking. They took around 28.5% of the vote. The big winner, I guess you could say, on the night, other than CDU/CSU, was the far-right Alternative for Germany party, which took just under 21% and is the second largest party in parliament. Coalition talks will begin, or may have already begun, I'm not 100% sure. AfD, Alternative for Germany, will not be part of those coalition talks. The cordon sanitaire will continue to be maintained for at least one more election around the far right. The most likely coalition to emerge here will be CDU/CSU and the Social Democrats, the SPD, which is the party of current Chancellor Olaf Scholz, and kind of ate shit, basically, taking a bit over 16% of the vote on Sunday. But collectively, I do think the two parties have enough for a bare majority in parliament. They may invite a third party in to sort of broaden their majority, although that makes things a little bit more difficult in terms of how you put a coalition together and what your aims are and how you expect to achieve them. But they may try to do that to give themselves a bit more of a cushion in parliament. I'm not sure actually that all the seat numbers have been worked out yet, but I do believe there's enough there for a two-party majority if they want to do that. AfD will, of course, be the opposition party, the main opposition party in parliament, and will be hoping to capitalize on this continued surge in popularity in 2028, I guess, assuming the government survives through its entire term. You know, the party did, as expected, very well in Eastern Germany, which continues to be a relic of reunification and the economic impoverishment of that region. It also did fairly well with younger voters, although the left party, the German left party, also did apparently fairly well with younger voters as well. It was definitely an anti-centrist feeling among the electorate, even though the center has once again clung to power barely. We'll see how it goes, I guess.
Thanks, Derek. So let's talk about these Austrian coalition talks.
Right. Speaking of far-right Germanic political parties coming uncomfortably close to power, Austria looks like it has a coalition deal in place that will exclude the far-right Freedom Party, which won September's parliamentary election, but finished well short of a majority. And, there's been a lot of debate over whether the parties that finished below it should try to form a coalition and exclude the Freedom Party from government. They've gone back and forth on this. The three parties that announced that they will or will, I guess, announce their coalition deal on Thursday, the People's Party, the Social Democratic Party, and the Neos Party, tried in the immediate aftermath of the election to negotiate a coalition that would exclude the Freedom Party. They failed. Those talks broke down, at which point the focus turned to the Freedom Party, which only really had the one potential coalition partner, which was the People's Party, which is pretty right-wing in its own right, but not quite as far as the Freedom Party, I guess. Those talks between those two parties went on for a few weeks, but they eventually broke down. I don't think anybody's really talked openly about this, but I suspect because members of the People's Party were not comfortable lending their support to a Freedom Party-led government, which would have been a dubious milestone in Austrian political history. So those talks broke down. And then again, President Alexander Van der Bellen of Austria turned to the People's Party and the Social Democrats to try and work out some sort of centrist compromise, nominally centrist at least. They went back to the Neos Party again, and the three parties have this time, I guess, with the fear of the Freedom Party or a potential snap election, which the Freedom Party would probably have done better than it did in September, at their backs, they were finally able to negotiate an agreement. So, liberalism has been saved for another few years.
Thank God. Liberalism in Austria continues. Let's talk about Trump ending this Venezuelan sanctions waiver.
Trump announced this on Wednesday. There's a sanctions waiver that the Biden administration gave to Chevron in 2022 to allow it to pump Venezuelan oil and then export it, process it, etc. That's worth at least hundreds of millions of dollars a year to Venezuela. The administration in 2022 issued this waiver as part of a deal that it struck with the Venezuelan government to under which the Venezuelans agreed to hold what the U.S. considers free and fair presidential election in 2024. Of course, that election has come and gone, and the United States rejected the results as fraudulent. There are concerns, broadly speaking, about the legitimacy of that election outcome, which saw Nicolas Maduro reelected, but also saw the Venezuelan government refusing, contrary to normal practice, refusing to release any sort of polling site data or granular level information about how the vote actually went. So that does raise some eyebrows. The deal that the Biden administration struck in 2022 obviously, didn't pay off, or at least didn't pay off the way the United States was hoping. And so Trump is justifying the decision to terminate this waiver on that basis. I think more relevant to him, he's also complaining that the Venezuelan government is moving too slowly to accept back Venezuelan nationals who are being deported by the U.S. And I think that's probably the more salient thing, given his interests. But some combination of those two things is going into this. And as I said, it will cost Venezuela a hefty amount of money when this thing is not renewed on Saturday.
Yeah, so we'll see how that goes. So U.S.-Canadian relations are just doing great. Let's talk about this Canada and Five Eyes situation.
Yeah, so we'll talk about the tariffs in a minute. The tariffs are back, maybe. But there was a report in the Financial Times earlier this week that Peter Navarro, who is a senior counselor in the White House on trade and manufacturing, has been pushing for basically for the United States to kick Canada out of the Five Eyes intelligence sharing network. Now, this is an Anglosphere concoction. The members are Australia, New Zealand, Canada, of course, the UK and the US, and they share intelligence. That's what it is. I mean, it is what it is. Navarro wants to kick Canada out, or supposedly wants to kick Canada out. I don't even know why. Like, I don't know what this is supposed to do. It's going to pressure the Canadians somehow into, I don't know, making trade concessions or like agreeing when Trump says that we want to turn Canada to the 51st state. Suddenly the Canadian government's going to say, okay, great. Yeah, whatever. We need the Five Eyes. You know, it'll be Four Eyes at that point, I guess, but we'll become part of the United States. I don't know what the end game here is. And I'm not sure even Navarro knows. He may just be, doing this to suck up to Trump. But he later denied the report in the Financial Times, and I want to read his denial because it is the most like protest too much statement I think I've ever seen. He said that we would never ever jeopardize our national security ever with allies like Canada ever. That was the word. Those were the words that came out of his mouth, which I take as confirmation that he's actually been advocating for this. But again, who knows what the thinking is here?
Let's end on an American lightning round. Let's start with these tariffs on the EU and maybe Mexico and Canada as well.
So Trump told reporters on Wednesday that he's planning to slap his usually favored 25% tariffs on imports from the European Union. He said very soon. I don't know what very soon means. Maybe he doesn't even know, but he's intending to do it. That's one piece of this. The Mexican and Canadian piece is that the 1 month grace period, you may recall, he slapped 25% tariffs on Mexican and Canadian imports several weeks ago. And then, you know, a couple of days later, after talking to Justin Trudeau by phone, talking to Claudia Sheinbaum by phone, imparted a 1 month grace period to both countries before these things would come into effect, and claimed that he had gotten concessions out of them, which really don't seem like all that much. But he did give them this 1 month grace period. Now that grace period is coming to an end. It will end next week. And he's telling people again, telling reporters that he's going to let these tariffs, he's going to impose these tariffs when the grace period ends. I assume another conversation with Trudeau and Sheinbaum will probably settle that. The precedent has been set here. Obviously we'll see. But on the subject of the European Union, this is a bit of a different animal for Trump. He genuinely loathes the EU. I'm not wholly sure why. He told reporters on Wednesday that the EU was formed to screw the United States. That was a quote. I think that may be a bit of an overstatement, but let's go with it. So he doesn't like these guys. He doesn't like Europe, period. There's been this controversy since he took office about the U.S. commitment to NATO, the U.S. commitment to European defense, that has sent European leaders scrambling to figure out how to break their decades-long dependency on the United States for pretty much everything. They're still not sure how to do that. So I do think there's a possibility that these EU tariffs will come into play, just because he's got a very special place in his very blackened heart for the EU that I'm not sure is quite the same with Canada. And even after sniping with Trudeau and so forth, I'm still not sure it's the same for Canada and Mexico.
Well, at least we've got this golden visa plan. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So Trump on Tuesday, again, he has these events in the Oval Office. This is like what he does all day. He signs executive orders and the press comes in and he just kind of, pops off to them about what he's thinking about any given day, which I think is, what he likes about the job. On Tuesday, he proposed taking what is the State Department's current investor visa program. It's the EB-5 visa. Was enacted in 1990. It offers residency to anyone who is willing to invest around $1 million in a commercial enterprise that would create at least 10 new jobs in the United States and give them, allow them to stay in the U.S. Trump has proposed replacing this program, which is admittedly, even according to the Congressional Research Service, a vector for corruption, has proposed replacing this with something that would be much less corrupt, of course, which is a $5 million golden visa, gold card, as he put it, similar to other programs around the world, where basically you would just pay the United States government $5 million and you could get a visa to live in the U.S. with a path toward U.S. citizenship. Trump talked about getting 10 million people to sign up for this and pay the $5 million, which would be a $50 trillion windfall, could pay off the national debt. I'm not sure you can find 10 million people who would be willing to do that, but you know, good luck to him. So this is apparently in the cards now, or something he's considering. Again, I'm sure it would be completely above reproach, as these other pay for residency schemes are around the world. They're always conducted with the highest regard for maintaining corruption, anti-corruption, and so forth.
The ethical standards are just enormous.
Yeah, the ethical standards. That's what I was looking for. Yeah.
Let's end on this humanitarian aid blockade issue.
Right. I mean, we've touched on this before. Trump's evisceration of foreign aid, which he first did kind of wholesale, and then we got these assurances from Marco Rubio and other people in the administration that they were issuing waivers to protect purely humanitarian programs. Well, golly, it turns out that they haven't really protected the humanitarian programs. Most of the aid that's been unfrozen as of earlier this month, it's been a couple of weeks. Reuters reported this last week and was already, they were looking at around $5.3 billion in U.S. foreign aid that had been unfrozen as of February 13th. Most of it, and I'm talking about like 80% of it, came from the State Department's Bureau of Political Military Affairs, which in other words means arms sales, basically, military aid programs, counter-narcotics programs, anti-migration programs, unsurprisingly, given this administration's interests. So only about $1 billion in actual humanitarian programs have received exemptions, and most of that, or about half of it, has gone to the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, which got around $500 million in its waiver, which is only a small portion of that program's annual budget, it must be said. But anyway, shock of shocks, this crowd, despite its insistence that it was protecting humanitarian aid, has only really protected weapon sales. Go figure.
Well, Derek, very, very surprising thing to have happened. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Check out our YouTube discussion on world government. Subscribe to the podcast so you can ask us questions on Discord. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.